I used to travel 50% of the year.
Oh, yeah, that's hard.
Which is just amazing if you think of on the road 50% of the year.
It's hard.
Because we worked in 46 countries.
Have I said too much?
Pretty soon you'll be telling stories that can't be told.
Welcome to my podcast, Whistler Stories That Need to Be Told. Today, I have Paul Matthews of EcoSign Mountain Resort Planners Limited. Paul started EcoSign in 1975 with one mission, to design the most sufficient, humanly pleasing mountain resorts in the world. Welcome, Paul. Could you explain what you've done? I know you've, you know, hundreds of designs of mountains. You've done Olympic venues. Have you got like the elevator speech on what your company has accomplished?
The summary is founded in 1975 by me. I couldn't get a job, so I get a business license for a dollar. And located in Timber Lodge and a storeroom. Sally Egan, remember Al Egan?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You had a storage room and that was your office?
That was where we started, yeah.
Wow.
And that was common space.
Mm-hmm.
And then grew from there. Now I own, quarter of the whole building, basically.
Two or three or four units or five units. And, you know, you still get this. They haven't bothered you about being a commercial.
No, they did. But we were there illegally under the regional district rules prior to the resort municipality of Whistler.
Right.
And so I got Al Rain, Gary Watson, John Hetherington.
The original council.
Pierce.
Jeff Pierce.
The first
administrator. Yeah.
To all vouch that, EcoSign was totally there before the municipality.
Yeah.
In fact, we hired EcoSign from that location to do all of our zoning maps and plans for the first few years because we had no ability. All kinds of funny stories over the years, but we're in there 47 years now.
Wow.
Right.
That's amazing.
So,
it's amazing to stay, like to be in one place that long.
Right.
It's pretty incredible.
And then the company started with, I had a job with Franz Wilhelmsen, Creekside, the parking lots. And then we had Hemlock Valley was an early project.
Yeah.
And the big breakthrough was 76. We got Mount Washington as a greenfield, brand new ski resort design.
Right.
Designed that, laid it out, and helped the construction. And it took off. It became second or third most visited resort in BC within three, 4 years. Right. And we still work at Mount Washington this many years later.
Wow.
So then we sort of branched out into British Columbia and then Idaho at Schweitzer and then some stuff in Washington State, then Alberta. And now we've done 550 different mountain resorts in 46 countries.
Wow.
Yeah. And so it's just
quite an accomplishment. Congratulations.
Yeah, it's a lot of work.
It is.
But then in the Olympics, we've done six Olympic Games, venues for six Olympic Games.
Planning the runs.
Planning the venues. And doing the bids.
Crowd control and all that kind of stuff.
First was Calgary 88, which is we did in 81, 82. And we found a new place to host the Alpine events, which is Nikiska.
Yeah.
And then we worked with Bernard Roussy, who was a new from the FIS.
Mm-hmm.
He had just retired from ski racing, so I've worked with him now for 40 years.
And he's the man, isn't he?
He's the man.
Yeah.
He's the designer of all the downhill courses.
Right.
We don't want to take any credit for designing downhill courses for liability purposes. But he tells us on the ground what he wants, and then we have to make the plans to give to the actual construction guys. So we're sort of almost like a translator,
Well, sure, because you got to know the vertical drop and the distance and the speeds and all that kind of stuff.
And how to shape the soil.
Yeah.
So 88 Calgary. 2002, again with Roussy in Snow Basin, Utah, the speed events.
Mm-hmm.
Then 2010, Whistler Blackcomb. Didn't work with Roussy on that one because they just used the Dave Murray downhill, but we did have to go design the new
women's side.
Yeah, we did the women's. We did that.
Bronzes.
The crossing.
The tunnel and everything.
Dave Felius engineered that tunnel.
Yeah.
And the technical events above the finish area were all new.
Right.
The slalom, the giant slalom with those had been in the bid over on Blackcomb, but we moved it on to Whistler to get one common finish,
right?
Which saves you a fortune,
in
capital and in operating costs.
And then we did
2014. Sochi made a presentation that they can do it, and they accepted it. And so then we did the bid for the Russian Olympic Committee to the IOC. I did the presentation on site to the evaluation committee.
Okay.
I got Wow. All the garbage picked up and the condoms out of the streets and the rivers. And God, it was well, just it a did. Mess. Russia's just such a,
you know, a mess. Yeah.
A mess. Yeah. It's like a garbage dump. So then so 2014 went off pretty good. Then we did 2018, the freestyle snowboard in Pyeongchang. Designed all those. Okay. There's six venues for the 20 competitions in freestyle snowboarding.
And the venues have just grown, haven't they?
It's very specific.
They started off with three or something in 68, I remember, when I was a kid. And then how many venues are in the Winter Olympics? There must be 20
I think
there's
109 now or something in the total Winter Olympics.
Yeah.
And the summer is more. Summer is probably 170 or something.
Wow, yeah.
And the freestyle snowboard has sort of morphed over time because after Cyprus Bowl, they got rained out and washed out. Mm-hmm. And then Sochi, they lost 10 feet of snow in a week due to warm temperatures.
Oh, yeah.
The FIS said no more making all this stuff out of snow. You have to shape the soil approximately close to the needs of the venues.
Oh, wow.
So you have, well, half pipe in aerials is easy because that's just a fixed thing. You can build it almost anywhere.
Yeah.
But the parallel giant slalom is very, very tricky because the course can't bend because that makes the blue course faster than the red course,
right,
et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that but needs specific gradients and rolls and bumps.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's the snowboard and the border cross and the ski cross.
Yeah.
Very complicated. Pretty low angle stuff, though.
Mm-hmm.
And the funny thing is that the ski cross is slightly different than the border cross because skis are faster than snow than boards.
Mm.
Skiers ride an edge. A lot. So you have to break. The courses have to diverge on some big bank turns, one for skiers and one for boarders.
Right, yeah. So they build those out of dirt now.
Yeah, it's all out of dirt.
Mm.
And all the jumps and rolls and, you know, and there's a lot of moving parts. Moguls, okay, that's also fairly fixed, but you got to find, that's very steep, and all these other things are fairly mellow.
Right? Yeah, the bumps are really steep.
So
yeah.
We did that in Pyeongchang, and then then Beijing hired us. We went against the Austrian guys and the Koreans and came up with a plan of where the venues. They just told us.
So you just found the mountain?
There's the whole mountain, the whole countryside. Yeah. Just go study the
basically. Best, the best one. Wow, that must have been quite a project.
But we know how to do that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And submitted the bid. So we were working for the bid committee at that time. We were selected, and then we went and did the design for the organizing committee.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had to do the construction monitoring for all one brand new alpine ski area. I think it cost 150 to 200 million. I don't have the accurate numbers.
And how many years? I mean, to put an Olympics together, it's got to be 10 to 7 years.
It's 7 years. They choose it 7 years before the games. So 2022 was actually chosen in July of 2015. So we had been working since 2012, 2013 with the bidding committee, and then you did the bids, and then we put the bids in 2014. We presented in the February of 2015, and then one was selected in July of 2015 for the 2022 games.
Yeah.
Then we had about a year to design all the stuff. All the freestyle snowboard was up at Genting Secret Garden, also a place where we were working. The alpine ski area, Yangqing, is a brand new mountain, and it was a tough one. It's so steep.
Big job.
Those were
big responsibility.
This was almost $2 million U.S. worth of work over a couple of years. So it was they're good projects for us. And now we're working with PC, Panorama, and Sun.
What do you think the chances are with that?
Not bad at all because Sapporo is a bidder. And then there's a bid from Spain, Barcelona region, Andorra. And I think our bid is pretty clever because we're going to use existing facilities.
Mm-hmm.
The only new facilities are all the freestyle snowboard. We're not going back to Cyprus
again. Blackcomb, maybe.
No,
on Whistler?
No, Sun Peaks is the chosen place.
Sun Peaks, interesting.
Right, which has perfect terrain, cold weather.
Yeah.
So that's for the 2030. So 2023 will be the selection.
Yeah.
So we're now working on the plans to submit for the Canadian Olympic Committee to decide and agree on all the venues.
Mm.
Panorama's putting up a little fight against Whistler for some of the alpine, but I think Whistler wants all the alpine. If it's a question
it would make
whether
sense.
We fit,
it makes sense.
Whistler has the expensive stuff, which is the jumps, 135 million or something back in whenever we built them in 07, 08.
Yeah, yeah.
The sliding center was another 140 million.
Gotta use it.
So even the Calgary bid, we said we're gonna use our
because it costs too much to build another one. Yeah. What would be really interesting to me, just personally, is what brought you here? Like, you know, I mean, you were a ski bum like the rest of us back in the '70s. You came from the States.
You lived in
Washington when you grew up. Went to the University of Washington.
Yeah. Well, I was born and raised in Colorado up to the age of 10.
Oh, okay.
And my dad got transferred, which is what fathers did in those days. You know, you just move. Everybody packs up. I got to Washington State, went up to Snoqualmie Pass, and it was quite different than skiing Loveland Pass or Breckenridge. Our family were members of the Breckenridge Ski Club.
No kidding.
In the early 50s Probably start skiing at 4 or 5. Mm-hmm. And dry powder snow, cold, all that stuff.
I go up high altitude.
High altitude. Yeah, I go up to Snoqualmie Pass. I don't even know if it's 2,000 feet, but maybe it's raining warm. Like hell. And I couldn't even believe that was skiing.
Yeah.
Then Whistler opened in '66, and I was up here January of '66 with a buddy on a bottle of bourbon and
checking it out. You're just a young teenager. Oh,
I was 18, and just loved the snow, the mountain, the Canadian size. Women were friendly.
Yeah.
The beer was
You
good.
Found women here in the 60s?
There was about 8 women here. When I first got here, I think there was, in 71, there was about 300, 350 population.
Yep.
And I always joke, 8 women, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
I knew at least one of them.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. You were lucky.
I survived. I went to university in the summer quarter because I was studying forestry, and they had these summer camps out in the forest where you're doing learning to survey and wood cutting, doing all dendrology,
tree cores,
identification, everything. Yeah, yeah. So that gave me the winter quarter off. So literally, I was off from December 10th or 12th until April 5 or 6, something like that. Yeah. All during my university, last 3 years at least, and was a ski bum here in Whistler. Mm-hmm. So
you weren't thinking of a career or anything?
No, as I was studying, I started to have the vision. Well, A, I said, I have to live in Whistler, okay?
Yeah.
And B, I want to live on the west side.
And why? Because of?
Because of the lifestyle.
I just love
this place. I just felt at home.
I did too.
It's hard to describe it, actually.
Yeah, I know.
But I know enough people who have the same feeling.
I did too. Everyone was here for a reason. It wasn't making money. It was to have fun and go skiing.
Right. Yeah, mostly centered around FUN.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then I started thinking, God, I got to find a way to earn a living up there. You know, I was skiing 100 days a year in those days. So then I had the idea. It was sort of in the early 70s. The environment was a big deal. And the way they were doing ski development was just brutal. I mean, if you'll remember Jack Bright and...
Oh, the logs and Franz's.
Logs and the bulldozers on the sewer.
Yeah, yeah.
Jack Bright asked me, he said, why do the rocks grow out of the ground every year? We clean it, we smooth it, and the rocks grow out. I said, Jack, the soil gets eroded away because you don't do any erosion control. You don't plant grass.
No cross stitches, nothing.
So that got us started on actually... So Whistler's been a bit of a test tube. So that's how I got here, and then it just grew. You know, then I got one employee, and then another, and then another, and then another job, and then we had to add more space at the office, and so it grew very slowly. What do you call it? Organically is the word.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You didn't plan it; it just kind of happened.
No, it was hardly a boom, but within 10 years, we were already up to about 12 to 14 people. We finally maxed out at around 20, which is sort of the level we've held now for probably 20 years.
Yeah. Right.
And revenue's steady. It's a profitable business if you manage it properly.
But you were thinking.
Telling, you know, at the old Tokum Hall, the Zymergist Club,
the beer festival,
that I was going to design ski resorts, and everybody
laughed at it. Yeah, right.
Man, he's really high tonight. Yeah. And so many people, I remember Drew Tate, I always remember you saying that, but the funny thing is, we all sort of believed you. We said,
well, you're serious. Actually, you had an education. You were going somewhere.
And I studied it just for it.
Yeah.
I crafted my degree in forest ecology and landscape architecture, right, which is the study of birds, bees, and trees, especially soil and water.
Right.
So I knew how to do things properly. And then the design half from
But there landscape. Was no education. You couldn't go there to a no, ski no, management no, no or anything like or that no. in those days. It no. was a... You were way ahead of the crowd.
Yeah, right. Just had a vision and implemented it. But first visit was 66, but sort of started the winter living here in 71. Yeah. I lived at Toad Hall. I'm in the famous photo.
I know. We're not going to tell who it is.
We don't have to spread that around. But,
that's an iconic historical event, and it was recorded, and it just shows. That's the year I came. Being naked
in those days,
naked was sort of normal.
You wouldn't believe it this year, but it used to be 25 degrees in May.
Yeah, exactly.
And sunny.
Exactly. Well, what kind of obstacles? Can you remember a major obstacle in your early years, or a major accomplishment?
The biggest breakthrough was in 75, the British Columbia NDP government, Davy Barrett, appointed Al Rain as the provincial ski coordinator.
Right.
Right? And so Al got in. He studied what was going on in the world. He was a ski coach with the national team, Nancy's husband.
He'd been around the world.
Been around the world. Yeah. And he said, well, main thing the British Columbia is missing is planning. So he writes this law that you need planning and master plans. Mm-hmm. The same year that EcoSign started.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an epiphany. That's just like, couldn't have asked for more luck in a way.
Yeah, well, but you were prepared. But that's the thing about luck.
It was just good timing that I had just graduated. All of a sudden, if you wanted to do a new improvement at a ski resort in British Columbia, you had to submit a master plan to the province.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, how did it work when the black comb thing came about? I remember you and Hugh were kind of competing right to develop black comb.
Right.
And Hugh won out because I think he had more money behind him.
No, he was with Aspen.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He had 20th Century Fox, Aspen.
I can tell a little story now that Hugh was secretly going to be our manager if we won.
Right on.
So I looked at Blackcomb, and Franz Wilhelmsen hired Bell Morgeson, who just said, no, Blackcomb is it's the wrong exposure, and it's too steep, and it'll never be a ski resort. Bad report. I still have a copy of that report somewhere. It's good.
That's good.
It's exactly what Franz wanted to hear for Whistler Mountain side.
Yeah.
But I studied it, and I said, this would be amazing. And to put the village down at the bottom between two Mile High Mountains.
Yeah.
That's never happened anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Then we were worried like crazy about the flooding in the village and the high water table. Mm-hmm. Actually, the village was built on ground. We didn't excavate because the water table is too high.
Yeah.
So we
and there was the diking and everything.
Yeah. Then they did the huge dike, the training wall, they called it, which was brilliant. And then all the parking is in the flood zone.
Yeah. Yeah.
So those the training wall and the parking sort of shaped how things were going to evolve. We went hunting, and we found my client from Panorama, Alan Graham, who had Cascade Corporation, big insurance guys and real estate developers.
Oh, yeah.
And so we, Ken Farquharson, the fairly famous environmental engineer, was my partner in the Black Home Skiing Enterprise. We put in a bid against Aspen in September 77, and by October 78 or 77, the province chose the Aspen guys, right? I actually laid out the mountain road with Hugh because Aspen said they'll start. We wanted to get the road up, the construction road up Blackcomb going in that fall so that they could be on the ground in 78 and 79. It was a 2-year build.
I worked on that with Gary. I remember building that road.
Gary. So we lost. 6 years later, Blackcomb.
Why did you lose?
Because Aspen Ski Corporation is just...
they had the money.
Their name and they had the money.
Yeah, right? Okay. Yeah.
And
they had more money.
They had more money, right. Yeah. It wasn't just the money. It was the quote, famous names of Aspen. Remember in those days of the papers?
It was Sin City.
Star Wars and Aspen and...
Yeah,
oh, God.
Yeah, they played it up.
Gossip.
Yeah.
But this all came back in 86. This was really lucky because in 86, Joe Hussein met Hugh Smythe at a YPO event. Yeah. Interwest was looking for some place to build condos. Hugh Smythe said, we have permission to build 7,500 beds on Blackcomb, all zoned and approved.
Jackpot.
Yeah, just take it away.
Yeah.
So Interwest came in.
Yeah.
And the first thing they wanted to do was redesign everything. And thank God they did, because the plans they had were from Aspen Guys Design Workshop. And all the benchlands was roads and single-family lots and some townhomes. Like, no skiing, no nothing, mm-hmm. right? It was just roads and real estate all the way up to base two. Can you imagine what Whistler would look like if that was what, if that we had done that?
Yeah.
Just eat it all up with cold beds.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I fits the warm bed theory to Hugh, he's completely sold on it, right? Mm-hmm. So then he said, okay, what can you do? And he said, well, I want to bring Blackcomb down to Fitzsimmons Creek to the level of Whistler Village.
Yeah.
And I had a vision in my mind that we were going to design a pedestrian road that went across from Fitzsimmons Creek onto Blackcomb and formed sort of a loop, right? We ended up building the road.
For cars, but
not really the pedestrian road that I envisioned. Blackcomb Village would have started just on the other side of Fitzsimmons Creek from our
where village. Snowy Creek development is.
Exactly.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So,
because that's more on the mountain.
Right. But the big idea I had was, well, there was two big ideas. One was detachable chairlifts, right? Which were very, very new in 1986.
Yeah.
There was only one. We had done one at the Kiska. In 83 or 84, mm-hmm. right? It was the only one in Canada. And Interwest board, Dan Jarvis and the Curry, the tax guy, they were really new to the ski business. So we just did the presentations. And because they were new, they sort of just listened to us instead of saying, well, I'm an expert. You know, I've been in the ski business 50 years. I don't believe in those detachable chairlifts. They're going, the consensus in those days from the experienced guys was detachable chairlifts made no financial sense at all. They're just
too costly.
Too costly.
Really?
But they didn't think cleverly. Okay. Yeah. Blackcomb we built for $6 million and we built 5 triple chairlifts for I think it was about $3 million. Okay.
Wow.
But $1,800 an hour. And it took 52 minutes
from the old lifts,
up to the rendezvous.
Yeah, in the old days,
I brought the Blackcomb ski runs down to the creek side, down to Fitzsimmons Creek.
Yeah.
And put in 2 detachable quad chairs, the Wizard and Solar. The travel time dropped from 52 to 13 minutes, right? And then we also told the board that, okay, so we got these 2 access lifts. We need to do another one that we're going to take all the people to. That became Seventh Heaven, the big Seventh Heaven pot. Hugh and Rich Morton in the day went to Europe, and they just went back and forth between Palma and Doffelmayr. And finally, Hugh got a deal from Arthur Doffelmayr for 3 detachable quad chairs, $4 million each, $12 million order. That seemed like a lot in those days, but I did the math. To get the same capacity, you would have had to put another triple chair beside each of the other 4 to get people, and it would still take you 52 minutes.
It's just logical.
It is now, but at the time,
it was a hard sell, wasn't it?
There was
that's funny.
Only 3 people, Don Murray, Hugh Smythe, and I, who believed it all.
Is that right, eh?
And wow. Now, of course, of course. But and then Joe Hussein was complaining that, I forget what the number was, he said, but you just, bringing the snow down to the village, you just ate up 20 acres of developable real estate.
Real estate.
Right?
Yeah.
And I said, Joe, I think I just created a mile of beachfront. And he went, that is a different way to look at
That's
it.
That's very right? smart. And, all those places on the ski run, it's all valuable stuff.
Ski in, ski out.
Yeah.
Burns real estate sells for 50 to 100% more than non-ski in, ski out.
Yeah.
Right?
Wow.
So the value was in doing that ton of white snow down there.
Yeah.
Don Murray and I, we had to survey how to get out there because it was all dense underbrush, alder,
willows
and everything.
Yeah, it was nothing.
And so Don and I surveyed it in with a hand compass and chains.
Wow.
And then we took Rich Morton and Hugh out there and they said, okay, so where's this new lift? I think lift 7. 7, 8, 9 is the ones we built. And we said, it's right here. And just looked around in all the bush. And here, he said, yeah, but 38 feet down. I said, 38 feet down? He said, yeah. So we had designed. So that was all sand and gravel.
Mm.
So we just, we wanted to get the lift on. You need to put lifts on competent ground.
Yeah.
Putting them on fill is quite dangerous engineering-wise.
Yeah.
So we just scooped all that sand and gravel, built the road, filled up, put some buildings in, the new day lodge, which was a 2-level thing, which gave us, helped us with 1 level.
Yeah.
And then the bridge with the with the pedestrian underpass.
Right.
And then we filled all that up. There was also the administration and kids building.
Yeah. What about Eldon Beck and the village design? I know Roger talked about traveling when you were doing Tromblon. He traveled with Eldon around Europe. And I guess he worked with you a little bit on those developments.
So we did all the mountain planning for Interwest, 12 resorts, I think it was.
Wow.
Yeah.
12.
Hmm. And our job was doing the transportation and parking, and within 100 or 200 meters of the lifts was an area that we cross-worked with Eldon. Okay. And so I worked with Eldon. He was brilliant. He was really good. His whole thing about the stream and the back eddies.
Yeah,
and
the
places.
Where people congregate.
Yes. That's really very, very successful in all of his villages at Tromblon. Whenever they bought a resort, actually, we were in first doing due diligence to help Hugh and Joe buy the place, right? We sort of would write an opinion of what it could do
the numbers.
What we thought the capacity could be and how many visits they could do, et cetera, et cetera. Mm.
Thank you for listening to the first half of my interview with Paul Matthews of EcoSign. Join us next time and hear from Paul how Whistler Blackcomb's Peak to Peak Gondola became a reality.